This is part of 10, 11, 12, a whole, you know, super passage, those several chapters that are extremely interesting to me from a a world history standpoint, an ancient history standpoint. And I mean, this is ancient history. This is as far back as you can go before you get before you fall into the waters of the flood, you know. And it's very, very interesting to me to see the course of human history and to have many things about it explained to us. Just very interesting to me for all of those curiosity reasons. You know, it's an interesting mechanism by which we can explore some very fundamental things about, you know, the human experience in the post-flood world. Very interesting. A statement that I think may not be perfectly true, but it is usably true, that I've been making recently, and so I should say this is not a statement that is found in Scripture. This is something that is usable, just only because it's usable. Is that a truth that you cannot live is, I shouldn't say irrelevant. I think that's the way I've been saying it, and I don't think that's right, but I can't find a better word. A truth that you can't live is something less than useful, you know, less than fully useful. If you can't live it, what good is it? And I know that many of you have experienced that before, and probably, unfortunately, at my hands, where you hear a sermon that is maybe to some extent interesting, at least mildly so, and sounds as though it's at least theologically accurate, but you leave unsure of what you should do, think, or say differently. And so it may have been, in many respects, a good sermon, but with no bite, you know? No real impetus to change anything, or no clear pathway as to how. And that does happen. And that's why the newspaper, for instance, has editorial pages. Of course, anymore, that's all the news is someone's opinion. But the concept of the editorial page is that here are things, the rest of the paper is to tell you what is going on, and this page is to tell you what we think we should think about it, you know? And there is a little bit of that that is really important when it comes to the Sunday message. And that's why I've been saying, as we look at these episodes from Genesis, of which I remain fully convinced, that they are historically accurate, that this is an accurate depiction of things that took place. But it has to be more than just an accurate depiction of things that took place. It has to be something you can live, or else there's no bite. And so when we read stories like the Tower of Babel, we look in them for an application because we know that God isn't just telling us this so that we will know what happened. He is telling us so that we will know what happened and therefore see something new about him and therefore live somehow differently ourselves. And that gives us a complete, and usable interaction with the truth. So as we've been defining Christianity as the life lived in pursuit of the one living God, we're going to see that in Genesis chapter 11 and just the first 9 verses, and chapter 12, the first 9 verses today, by way of contrast. This is Genesis 11, 1 through 9. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And then they said to one another, come and let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, these people are one and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, and let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. And therefore its name is called Babel, confusion. Because the Lord had confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord had scattered them abroad over all the face of the earth. One could say, and I don't think any of us would, that these people are pursuing God. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. And so there is some superficial sense in which it looks as though they were trying to approach God, you know, spatially or directionally. But where are their hearts? And that, I think, we could just about have the closing prayer. Because superficially or, you know, directionally, it may appear that we are trying to approach God, but where are our hearts? And that is a problem that we'll deal with in just a couple of minutes. Where are their hearts? Come, they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. Like, we have a methodology for this. In verse 4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and build a tower. Let us make a name for ourselves. And there we see. So, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And so we read here what they said, and that tells us pretty plainly where their heart is. They are not building a tower upward to more closely approach God. They are not building a tower upward to more visually represent the supremacy of God. And we hope that when we build a church building on top of a mountain and then give it a big pointy hat, we hope that that is what we are doing, right? We are giving a spatial, visual representation of our belief in the supremacy and exalted nature of God. We're not trying to crown our community, you know, and give sort of like the medieval divine right of kings, where you can say that your community has some special relationship to a divine being and therefore it's superior. All right? We're not trying to crown our community. We're not just trying to, you know, beautify a neighborhood. Right, but we are trying to give a spatial visual representation of our internal belief in the supremacy of God. It is an architectural analogy for what we do in the waters of baptism. We don't enter the baptistry in order to get closer to true salvation, right? But as a visual representation, a ceremonial declaration of something that we believe is true about our relationship to God. That is not what is happening here. This is not a visual, spatial representation of their belief in the supremacy of God. And we know that because of what they say. And out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. What they say is, let us make a name. And that's a real problem. Right. So I return to the question I asked, you know, the problem that I presented. Can we superficially show something that looks like an approach to the heavens and yet have a heart that is in completely another place? Can we? We can do that almost more easily than we can do anything else. And here we have a problem that we often fall into and easily fall into and sometimes unknowingly fall into, because it's the problem of a real similarity between actual Christian growth and self-deification. You know, they are not just trying to approach God. They're not just pointing upward to God. They're not trying to come close to God, but they are doing things superficially. They are building a tower to the heavens that someone might do if they were trying to approach God. You know, superficially, some of these activities may seem to represent a good heart. And again, I'm kind of steering that back toward us because we know that's not the case here in chapter 11. But we may do things that can indicate a good heart, but that are not actually indicative of a good heart. We can engage in whole modes of being in the world that sufficiently duplicate what a good Christian would do without being one. Now, often we'll do a poor job of it, and that's good. That's a good diagnostic. You know, that shows us maybe where our heart's wrong. Oh, I can't sustain this more or less Christ-like mode of being because I'm not right with Christ. Now, that's good. That tells you what's the problem. But we can do that. And sometimes our focus is on that mode of being in the world rather than actual growth, which will then produce that mode of being in the world. They said in their hearts, let us build. And sometimes we do the same thing. We say in our hearts, let us build, rather than things like, let us seek. Right? Rather than seeking God, rather than following God, rather than loving God, rather than learning from God, we are trying to build. Build a better life, build a better self, build a better church, build a better community, build whatever. You know, whatever your cause is. Rather than seeking God. These people are building, and that's great as a byproduct or as a result of seeking God. But they are not seeking God. They are seeking to make gods of themselves. And we know that because they say it in words. And they say it to one another, all understanding one another. And I have no qualms whatsoever about believing in divine intervention on the massive scale in the human experience. And so my opinion on chapter 11 is that chapter 11 says exactly what chapter 11 intends to say about the supernatural confusion of the languages by the deliberate act of God. If your God isn't big enough to do that, mine's bigger, right? My God has the capacity to do those things and is interested in giving you whatever opportunity you need to see the light. And sometimes divine punishment is a gateway. So the Lord scattered them abroad. So how do we deal with this similarity so that we are not in our own lives and hearts in a very real and tangible way scattered abroad? You know, how do we avoid divine judgment because we are not just building something that simulates good Christianity, but we are actually following and seeking God? Because there's a real problem. Your Christian experience is not just about, or your human experience for that matter, is not just about seeking pleasure over pain, right? That's not just what it's about. Now, most of us would rather be happy than miserable, right? Well, okay, maybe you wouldn't. Yeah. Everybody knows about my affinity for Arby's roast beef sandwiches and three pepper spicy sauce. Many of you are also aware of my affinity for a king-size Reese's Fast Break, of course. All right. I would rather be happy than miserable. Sometimes I eat one, and I think if I ate another one, I might die, but I would die happy. All right. And there's a real pull there, you know. And I wrote a blessing over the Memorial Day weekend, and everybody looked at me in two different family gatherings like I was a lunatic. All right. Which, there's a case to be made for that. But I said, may you live well, not long. All right. I think that's beautiful. All right. Brittany had one uncle that liked it. All right. And I'm like, he probably means he's the most genetically Welsh out of that side of the family that has a Welsh strain in it, because they're pretty nuts, you know. And the Welsher you are, man, it's great. Interesting people. May you live well and not long. You know? We would all like to be happy, not miserable. But that is not the sum total of the purpose for your entrance into the world. You know, the more pleasure you try and squeeze out of the world, the more people you're squeezing to death. You know, if you are maximizing your pleasure, it will probably be at the expense of the greater good. Plus, you will fail. If your life is the pursuit of pleasure over pain, you lose, and you always lose. It's a dead loss, right? And I like sometimes, because there maybe some of you feel the same way, and it's good for you to know that others exist, but I like sometimes to put out there my generally negative view, all right? The human experience is full of pain and ends in death. And so if your pursuit is pleasure over pain, you lose, all right? You're not always going to be happy. Right, someone you love is going to die, like all of them. Right, some part of your body is going to fail eventually, all of them. Right, you are one of those people that someone else loves who's going to die. You know, and in the meantime, you're going to suffer tremendously. Right? And and you're going to sin magnificently. So if your human experience is the pursuit of pleasure over pain, you lose. So you definitely want to change the framework, because that's the wrong frame of reference, right? That's a losing game. So people say, you know, particularly people who are mad at God, you know, the game is rigged. The game is rigged. And that's part of the underlying concept of the book of Ecclesiastes. The game is rigged. But what you don't understand, or what you may not understand, and you need to understand, is that it's rigged in your favor. Because you get to change the framework. And that's the coolest thing about being a human, all right? We are the only things on the planet that know that we ourselves are going to die. Plants and animals do not recognize their own mortality. Now, they go out of their way to sustain their lives, to stay alive, all right? And some of them are really good at it, all right? Turkey season just ended with a whimper for me, all right? Like, they're pretty sharp at staying alive. They don't want to die. But what they do not know is that eventually they will. We, in our self-consciousness, are aware of our eventual expiration, right? And so we understand the framework of our life in a unique way as humans. And so if you don't like the game that you're playing, stop playing that game, all right? You ever play, how many of you have house rules for like Monopoly, all right? What does your, in your family, what do you do with free parking? Right? Everybody has their own variation of what happens when you land on free parking. Right? Because knowing that it's a game and therefore has rules that we've all agreed on, you get to change the rules. Right? You get to change the rules. Now, if you talk about a rigged game, you get to make the rules. Not for how life works, but for how you're going to pursue it. And that's great, because you are not stuck with pursuing what we are naturally geared to pursue, which is pleasure over pain, at which game you will certainly lose. The game is rigged in your favor. You get to pick a different set of rules. You're not stuck playing by the set of rules that will certainly defeat you. What other rules are there? The rules they're living by here, the Tower of Babel, is this like process of self-actualization. And we talk about that a lot because it's a lot more exalted than just, you know, basic hedonism where I'm in it to enjoy life as much as possible and live as long as possible. It's much better. I'm here to be the best version of myself I can possibly be. And that sounds very exalted. And I used to have this stupid idea. I've traded in for other ones, I'm sure. I used to have this stupid idea, and I even had a stupid name for it that's so embarrassing, I'm not even going to say it. Not in the plenary session. I can't take it. I was trying to fulfill whatever human potential I may have had, which that'll disappoint you in a hurry, too, because God had, you know, created me and had therefore invested that potential in me. And so the best way I could glorify God with my life was to maximize my own human potential. That's idiotic. All right. We're going to shortcut to the end of probably a decade of suffering. And I'm just going to give you the punchline. That's also a terrible way to live. All right. You will also lose because you don't even know what the limits of your human potential are. How will you, if the limits of your human potential are the measurement of a life that was worth the suffering that you will necessarily have as part of the human experience, how will you know if you ever achieved it? Like, what's the end of the game? You know, how do you get your own human potential in checkmate? How do you corner the best version of yourself and say, I got you now. I've achieved you. I've conquered the life to the extent that I can. How will you ever know that? Right? You live and die in complete uncertainty as to whether you're there yet. Right? Don't want to live that way either. So how about a third option that we've seen in a lot of people, including some strains of what you might call broader Christianity, and maybe we see it better in, say, Buddha, for instance, which is like self-transcendence. We can't just please ourselves, and we can't just maximize ourselves. Let's transcend ourselves. Again, there's something to be said for that, just like I like a Reese's Fast Break, and we'd all prefer to be happy rather than miserable. Like, there's something to be said for all of these things, but none of them are sufficient, right? So whether it's on the scale of just pursuing pleasure, or whether it's on the scale of, you know, transcending yourself, or whether it's in between, you know, the concept of maximizing yourself and your potential in the world, all of them fail, right? All of them fail. Some of them fail differently, better or worse than others, wherever you want to be on that gradient, but they all fail, right? And they're all a losing game. So how do you, how do you change the framework? How do you enter into a set of rules by which, a mode of being by which life is worthwhile? You could say that it's not that easy to do. Or you could say that it is. In Genesis chapter 12, we see the difference. It's not just about maximizing ourselves as Christians, even. All right? It's not just this. It's not self. Life isn't self-actualization, which is what's happening here in the Tower of Babel. And it's not even just self-actualization in a Christian context. And I have to admit that I have framed it that way in my own mind over a sufficient span of time that although I no longer believe that, it probably still comes out of me inadvertently. I still may express my thoughts about Christian growth, because I know I talk about that an awful lot, because it deserves to be talked about an awful lot. I probably still inadvertently couch it in terms that make it sound like it's Christian self-actualization. Be the best Christian you can be. Well, you should oughta, but here's why. And this is the distinction that solves the problem, all right? Like I said, there's this problem of the similarity between Christian growth and some kind of camouflaged self-actualization. And the distinction that solves that problem is in chapter 12. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh. And the Canaanites were then in the land. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." And there he built an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel. He pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. It's worth noting here in passing that we see here a trajectory in Abraham's life that very much parallels the same trajectory we saw in Noah's life last week, where God calls him, he responds. God commands him, he obeys. Right? God preserves him. He blesses God, he praises God, and is blessed. And we see, especially as you continue through the life of Abraham, you see that like on a loop. You see a continual demonstration of the same things that we talked about in the life of Noah. And that is a demonstration of what the life of full faith is like. Abram believes God and is counted to him for righteousness. That Abraham believes God, and so he obeys him, and so he is blessed. That Abraham passes through some real difficult things, and God continues to preserve him. If you want to talk about a life that maximizes pleasure over pain, Abraham doesn't need to follow God's command to leave Ur, and then again, after Terah dies, his father dies in Haran, to leave Haran and continue on this journey. Because Abraham is already rich, and his wife is beautiful. And that's pretty much the combo deal. Right, he's got pretty much everything that everybody around him envies. And that's why he's got to lie about his relationship to Sarah, because he's so scared that he's going to get killed and she's going to be taken from him. All right, at age 80, that's a pretty well-preserved individual. All right, these people are not young. All right, and she's still such a looker that he's afraid of how people are going to treat him. There are worse problems to have, and he's filthy rich. All right. And we see that as the course of the story goes. Again, Genesis like 14, 15, those are some of the most dramatic and beautiful passages in the Old Testament about his relationship to God, particularly as relates to the rescue of Lot. I know I've talked about that before, but so as we are pursuing the one living God and living our life for that purpose, not for our own purposes, not for the promotion of our best self, and not even for the transcendence of ourself, but to pursue the one living God, all right? We are living, but we are not God. And so the pursuit of that personal deification is the opposite of Christianity. We need to pursue something that is alive but isn't us. And here's how it happens. Now the Lord had said to Abram, right? God, whose selfhood is fundamentally different from ours, initiates the relationship. And that's what makes it faith in the one true and living God, is that he approaches you first. We've got to respond, right? We have to respond. The Lord calls Abram out, right? And Abram does, in fact, obey. The things that will happen to him and the opportunities that he will have to demonstrate faith, particularly in the inchoate sacrifice of Isaac, are unknown to him at this time. But they do happen. And this is sort of the inception of Abraham's life of faith. And so he continues to pursue God with greater or lesser success as God continues to lead him out. And so although there may be a superficial similarity between some kind of Christian self-actualization and a life actually lived in pursuit of the one living God, there may be a superficial similarity, but the difference is faith, because faith is the catalyst for that pursuit, the catalyst that changes us from more or less inert forms destined for a mortal doom to people that are living a life that is in pursuit of something, someone who is so exalted that the conditions of life that we have to bear are worthwhile. That's how you change the frame. It's not about your pleasure in life, it's not about your potential in life, and it's not even about transcending your selfhood, because it's not primarily about your selfhood. It's about his. And as we pursue in response to his initiation of that relationship by which he calls us out to our destiny, when we are pursuing him in the direction that he is leading us, life is worthwhile. And if you question whether that will really satisfy you, then I refer you back again to Hebrews 11:6. That we must believe that God is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. The life destiny that has sufficient reward is the one lived in faith in that pursuit of God, that he rewards those who diligently seek him. And as we continue to diligently seek him, we are rewarded. And that is the life that has a reward sufficient to counterbalance its suffering. Abraham's life is not particularly easy. It's pretty great. Like, it's pretty grand. It's somewhat flamboyant, almost. Again, this huge semi-nomadic agricultural empire, a modest personal army. Like, the guy, you know, he lives in pretty high on the hog, you know, in terms of their social, economic framework. So it's a pretty grand life, but it is not a life without difficulty. And we see sometimes the pain that Abraham has to carry at different episodes in the story. But because he continues to pursue God in faith, he's living a life in pursuit of the one living God, because, and we see this in Abraham's life, and I've been saying this the last couple weeks, and we see it in his life demonstrated, that being with God is not a static thing. That because God is always moving, because he also is a thing that is alive, right? He is always moving, and so our life with him is also in motion. And we see that in Abraham, demonstrated in a literal geographical way, because he circles the Middle East in his, you know, semi-nomadic lifestyle. And your life with God also will be one in motion, and with motion there is friction, you know, and you're going to have suffering in life, but it is that constant reward that comes from knowing that God is and that he rewards those who seek him. That life is the life that is sufficiently rewarding to counterbalance its suffering. And faith is the catalyst for that pursuit. So I think that we have a powerful contrast between the exaltation of the self in Genesis chapter 11 and the exaltation of God in Genesis chapter 12 as we live a life of worship because it's a life of obedience. Now what happens, so we need to know that, all right? And that's an important thing to know, that there is a huge distinction between everything good we might do to promote our Christian growth and everything good we might do that is Christian growth, because it springs from a growing, deepening relationship with the person who has called us out. So again, superficially, a lot of our actions and habits may be the same, but faith makes the difference. Are our external observable modes of being, are they a result of our desire to cultivate a better mode of being? Or are they a result of a deepening relationship with God because our faith in him is such that we believe that that life is worth it, that pursuing him is worth it, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him? Makes an awful difference. And the depth of your faith and its central place in your life is something I cannot see. We can see it in ourselves, but we don't always look. We don't always know what we're looking for. And that's hopefully what I do as a minister, is help you to see things that we can all read. You know, the Bible doesn't require a whole lot of explanation. I'm not really trying to explain much to you. I'm hoping to help you see it in a different light and see how it applies to you. I'm not trying to invent anything, but just to help you see it and absorb it. And so as we see that Scripture is saying what Scripture has said for thousands of years, how does it change us? And so hopefully, as I say, we don't always know where to look inside to see if that kernel of faith is what is growing inside us, or whether we're just adding layers of what are good things on the outside. And this is what the New Testament is referring to when it talks about our works being tried by fire. You know, you don't have to test something. You don't test garbage. You know, it's not talking about our bad works being tried by fire. Our bad works, we know, are worthless. And we know full well. And that's where guilt comes from. And guilt's a great teacher. It's our good works that have insufficient motivation that turn out to be wood, hay, and stubble. They may be useful for something for some time. But in a farming community, we know the hay doesn't last long, right? It gets pretty quickly processed, and it doesn't come out the way it went in. You know, not everything has long-term stability, all right? Gold, silver, and precious stones. So many of the things that, that wood, hay, and stubble alike are useful for what they're useful for, but there's not staying power. And when God looks at our hearts and says and adjudicates whether your good works were the fruits of a seed of faith, or whether they were the veneer of self-actualization. I hope that makes sense. God is the one who knows, and so do we, if we're looking inside ourselves, but we don't always know where to look. So here's where you can look. Are you fully convinced not only of God's existence, but also of the fact that he rewards those who diligently seek him? And if you are fully convinced of those things, you're probably very near the faith of Abraham. And Abraham, although he had a much different life from most of us, he was just a dude like us, you know, just a human being. And so if Abraham can have that faith that makes him a friend of God, so can we. And that is just about, out of all the dim view I often have of the human experience, that is about the most positive thing I can think of. That it is an accessible reality for a human being to have what Christ calls the mustard seed of faith, sufficient that we can be fully convinced of God's existence and his desire to reward those who diligently seek him, and that any one of us can be a friend of God like Abraham. I can hardly conceive of anything more overwhelmingly positive. And I am not by nature a positive person. And that, it just steamrolls me with this realization that we can share in the faith of Abraham and have a life of obedience and blessing. And so I hope that our understanding of faith as the catalyst for changing us from inert mortal forms into lives that are truly worthwhile I hope that understanding sits inside us deeply enough that we will nurture that seed of faith and that we will cultivate a convinced appreciation of those things that are true about God's relationship to us. That we may be alive, but we are not the living God. And He is, and He has called us out. I'd like to take a moment now in consequence of that idea and talk about that calling out for just a moment. It may be inaccurate to refer to it in the past tense, but I'm going to refer to the global events of the last 2 months or so in the past tense only because they are becoming more rapidly past tense for us. So in our experience, this is so. As at least we and many rural communities especially are emerging from pandemic life, as we've known it for the past 6 weeks or so. Goodness. How long has it been? It's been a lot more than 6 weeks, hasn't it? Well, that's weird. They say time flies when you're having fun. Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun, I guess. I hope that we have learned something from that experience. Any experience like that has the potential to teach you tremendous things. And I would say that in a metaphysical sense, that's the reason those things happen. We were all blessed or forced to spend a lot more time with the people that we often spend considerable time avoiding. And in some cases, that's literally true, all right? We all know, and it enrages all of us, that there were kids for whom school is an escape from really horrible situations, right? And they were stuck in those situations because school wasn't in session. And so they literally spend a lot of time avoiding their home life because it is a thing to be avoided. A lot of people had the opportunity to spend more time with the people that they've always wanted to spend more time with and haven't felt like they had the time. And it was when you cannot engage in the things in which you normally engage, that is a real eye-opener. Most of you know Ed O'Connor, right? If you don't know Ed O'Connor, you need to get to know Ed O'Connor. He's a super guy, and I don't know anybody I think much of that really thinks otherwise, right? He's like universally accepted as a super guy, you know? And he goes to Rome Presbyterian. A lot of you know him. He sells, White Barn Farms down here at the bottom of the hill, sells Christmas trees and so on. I really like the guy. And he has this this video segment that the Rome Presbyterian Church was putting out called "That's What I Saw." And it was really very interesting. And of course, I shared the one video, and probably some of you saw it. I shared it with the caption, 100% chance you need more Ed in your day, And that particular talk, he called "How Fast Was I Going?" And Ed, from what I understand, by his own admission, is a pretty slow driver, right? Which is fun if you're riding with someone, not if you're behind them, And he said he got a speeding ticket once in his life. He didn't realize how fast he was going. He was preoccupied with the death of someone that he knew and wasn't paying attention, and we've all been in that situation. He was pulled over, and the officer asked, how fast you were going? And in point of fact, he had no idea. It was not what he was thinking of at the time. And he said that this whole situation reminded him of that time, where he had to take stock of when suddenly you've got to put the brakes on life as you know it. You've got to ask yourself, how fast was I going, right? If you stop quickly, the more things that fall apart inside the vehicle are an indication of how fast you were going, also the age of your vehicle. If you've got to put the brakes on your life, the more things that fall apart indicate how fast you were going, And the other night, and I suppose this was technically untrue because it was Memorial Day weekend, which is a bye week anyway, but we had grilled hot dogs outside with the kids, and I pulled my chair, is a habit I developed, I pulled my chair up next to Brittany so that we were like this far apart and facing each other, and the campfire was to our side. We're there talking, and I was rubbing her feet, and I said, it's quarantine, which I know isn't the right word, but self-isolation, whatever. I said, this quarantine saved my life. And she's like, why? And I said, we wouldn't be doing this. Memorial Day weekend, again, it's probably technically incorrect, but I'm like, you probably would have been here with the kids, and I would have been at a softball game. As much as I don't mind going out and playing softball with everybody, the fact is, you know, it's nice to get your priorities straight. And I was, like, required to spend whole weekends, you know, basically together. And because state parks were still open, we've been hiking all over the place with the kids. And I have been, in many respects, happier. And that's not to make light of a global disaster, but it's to take stock, all right? Take stock. How fast were you going? Now, what does this have to do with Abraham? Frankly, everything. I can just about guarantee you that when life is radically changed, all right, God is talking to you. Are you listening? All right? What did he just call you out from? In the Mesopotamian creation myth, Tiamat and Abzu, the goddess of salt water and the god of fresh water, are locked in this primordial embrace, which produces all of the basic human urges, lust, anger, love, everything. And they're personified as like the elder gods of the Mesopotamian people. Because those urges are so out of control, which you know they are, they accidentally kill their father. And so they build, again, because it's all these weird old stories, they build their world on his corpse, right? Now, we all do that, right? The past is dead, and yet that is what we build our lives on. We build our lives on the past, all right? What is God calling you out from that is in your recent past and needs to be different? And do we have the faith to follow, knowing that whatever it is he wants to change, he will reward our search for him? You have probably been called out, right? This has not left any of us unaffected. And so probably all of us have learned something that needs to change if we were listening. Full faith that he lives and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Nurture that mustard seed of faith. And when God calls us out to a new way of living, which is radical, all right? And literally, he calls Abraham out from the corpse of his father. It's like the same story. He has just buried his father in Haran, and God says, now leave and move on. I'm calling you into something that is radically unlike your past. There is probably something that these last couple of months have taught us to do differently as individuals, potentially as a church. I am terribly afraid that we will go back to everything as normal and miss something we could have tweaked and should have learned. So have your eyes open and to what is happening around you and your ears open to the call of God as he helps you progress from the corpse of your past. How fast were we going? Have the faith of Abraham as God has called you into whatever he wants you to change in your post-pandemic life. And let's pray together and let's kind of devote ourselves to that faith of Abraham. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for catalyzing our existence. We thank you for changing us radically from merely biological units to something that is alive in spirit. That being dead in trespasses and sins, you've made us alive. Thank you for saving grace and the faith that activates it. Help us to live actively in that blessed faith. As you call us out into a life that very literally changes day after day, help us to genuinely be people who live and learn. Take us a step at a time. Help us to be patient when the going is slow, and strong when the going is hard. And we know that it will be hard from time to time. But thank you that despite the tragedy of life and the genuine evil that is present in the world, that life can be worthwhile when it is lived for you. And thank you for making that opportunity available to all who live and who respond to your call. Thank you for calling us out and calling us forward. Thank you that we're not just building a tower upward, but that we are taking a journey onward. In Jesus' name, amen. If you'll stand and sing with us again, please.